If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove and I edit the magazine. This is the second of our February 2012 podcasts. But more interestingly, for those of you who have a natural affinity towards anniversaries, this is the 100th edition. We are now venerable indeed, and we wouldn't have got this far without you taking the time and trouble to download and listen to our interviews. So thank you all for your support. Before we get on with this centenary edition, I ought as ever to remind you that BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Our website is historyextra.com, and we're on Twitter at twitter.com/historyextra or facebook.com/historyextra. The current issue of the magazine, for those of you in the UK, is a corker with a roundup of the questions that need answers about the British Empire, a feature on Tudor martyrs, Charles Dickens on trains, the battle for scientists after the Second World War, and a short history of sport. Now, this week we have just one interview, but it's a special extended one involving you, the listeners. So coming up, we have...
If I ever thought that we got to the moment where we knew everything there was to know about the First Crusade and everyone was going to agree, I would actually be quite horrified, because it would kill it as a subject.
That was Tom Asbridge of Queen Mary University of London on the Crusades. Just before we start with the interview with Tom, I have a special anniversary offer for you. To celebrate our 100th podcast, we're offering all UK listeners an opportunity to sample BBC History Magazine for free. Simply call 0844 776 0306. That call will cost between 3.5 and 5p a minute from a BT landline in the UK. Other operators' charges may vary. The offer is only available for UK delivery addresses and is subject to availability. So call us quick to get hold of your free issue of BBC History Magazine. That offer ends on the 29th February 2012. Now, Tom Asbridge is Reader in Medieval History at Queen Mary University of London. He is an expert particularly on the Crusades, and his three-part series entitled The Crusades has just aired on the BBC. As you might recall from previous podcasts, I've been asking you to tell me what questions you would like to ask Tom Asbridge. You are not shy in coming forward, so I met Tom armed with a sheaf of questions and put them to him cold. This is the result. So listen now to our very first Ask the Historian podcast interview. So we've got lots of questions, some from Twitter, some from email. So I've sort of tried to order them vaguely chronologically. The first question is from Twitter. It's from Marlin Books Limited, which I assume there's a person behind that. But the question is, what do you think was the principal motivation for the Crusades? Actual religious concerns, land, or long-term prosperity? Now, that's a question that you did consider in your series, but perhaps you'd like to run over the answer again.
Well, I guess one of the things we should say right from the start, if we're talking about something like the First Crusade, is this: there are so many people who enlist in the First Crusade, somewhere between 60 and 100,000 people, that I think it would be impossible to come up with a singular answer to say this is the sole purpose, the sole motivation for every single human being that participated in this massive venture. Similarly, I guess I'm also of the mind that it's not in our own world now always necessary to only have one purpose for doing something. I think that's also very, very much true in the Middle Ages. And I think one of the things that's most fascinating about the Middle Ages, one of the things that keeps me interested in it as a period of history, is the kind of the moments that gel with what we're familiar with today and the moments which are unfamiliar. And I think one of the things that's striking about the First Crusade is there are elements in motivation that seem to be immiscible, things that couldn't be coexisting at one and the same time, that I think in the Middle Ages have no real difficulty existing in that way. So on the one hand, there's a very strong argument in current scholarship and current historiography, and something that I pursue and argue in the series, which is that religious devotion is at the core of people's decision to answer the call to crusade. But I also think there's, certainly in the way the expedition plays out, there's an element of material gain, of acquisitiveness, of interest in booty and plunder that you cannot deny on the part of the first crusaders. And what I think is clear in the way events like the sack of Jerusalem in the summer of 1099 play out is that for those people participating, there seems to have been no disjunction between the idea that they're doing the work of God and they should be rewarded with some kind of material benefit when they take Jerusalem. Where I would slightly differ with the question is to say in terms of long-term prosperity or territorial gain, because one of the things we know with hindsight is that almost all the people who participated in the First Crusade, the vast majority of them who survived, then went back to Europe after the Crusade finished. So I don't think we can imagine that the whole Crusade was conceived as a massive land grab, but I'm not opposed to the idea that there's an element of materialism alongside spirituality.
There's another question which I've had from Matt Shaw on Twitter, which is along this theme. Does anyone still disagree with Jonathan Riley Smith on the motivation of the Crusaders? Which I suppose is basically the same sort of question. But is that how much contention is there about what motivated the Crusaders among the academic community?
Sure, it's a good question, I think, because one of the other things that always strikes me about academic life is that things go in cycles, and an idea tends to hold its position maybe for a 30, 40 year cycle, and then people start popping up and saying, hang on a minute, perhaps we can come up with a different way of looking at that. It's very true to say that Jonathan Riley Smith, back in late 70s, early 80s, started putting forward some very, very powerful arguments on the basis of close reading of evidence, advocating this idea of spiritual motivation being at the core, and that found expression in the work of one of his PhD students called Marcus Bull, who wrote on knightly piety in certain areas of France. But it's not as if this has been completely unchallenged. So there's a historian called Connor Kostick, who's brought out a couple of books related to the First Crusade, but one of which is very much looking at other motivations, economic motivations, not just materialism. And so there is an argument going on. I'm personally not convinced that Kostick has got it right, but I think he's got an interesting line of argument. And I guess I subscribe to the idea of an approach to history where I don't think there is an end answer. If I ever thought that we got to the moment where we knew everything there was to know about the First Crusade and everyone was going to agree, I would actually be quite horrified, because it would kill it as a subject. So I don't think we're going to get to some ideal truth where we're going to know for sure that is the motivation, that's the end of it. I think it's going to be an ongoing debate because it's the nature of our evidence.
But you don't see any particular contradiction between the idea of people going out there sincerely and piously and then becoming more acquisitive and looking for opportunities when they get there?
Or not even becoming more acquisitive. They may have had some idea that there may be a degree of material reward even as they set off. We know certainly one of the characteristics of the First Crusade in particular is that it's not supported by any complex network of logistics. So they have to forage, they have to seek plunder as they pursue this expedition in order to sustain themselves. Where Kostick is arguing and where there's more debate is about the kind of stimulus that might make people want to leave Western Europe. How much was it to do with the economic situation in Europe? Was Europe in a situation where it couldn't take any more population growth? Those are some of the ideas that have been espoused 30, 40 years ago, which I think, personally, I think, are less convincing.
Okay. Leading on from that, we've got a question from Marie A. Parsons, who has asked, what economic or other benefit, not just religious, in brackets, did the Crusader kingdoms reap for themselves in Europe? So I think she's asking, what she's trying to get at is was there a flow of money back to Europe as a result of the Crusades?
There was, to an extent. I don't think that we can imagine that was the primary reason why they were orchestrated or continued through the 12th century. And it's a bit too broad to say a benefit for Europe. Some of the major players that really are catapulted in a much greater way onto the world stage in commercial terms are Italian city-states like Pisa, Genoa, and Venice. And they certainly gain in their trading power and ability to manifest their will in Eastern Mediterranean as a result of the Crusades. And the Crusades and the foundation of what we call the Crusader states, the Christian settlements in the Eastern Mediterranean, they certainly result in a developing conduit of trade between East and West, which has benefits for Europe, but also has benefits commercially for the Muslim Near East.
Okay. All right, moving on. A question from Emir O. Filipovich. How instrumental was the belief of Crusaders in the success of the First Crusade, especially in the context of faced adversities? Now, you did cover this a bit, I suppose, in the Siege of Antioch story, where the famously the Holy Lance is found, and that seems to spur him on. But so he's asking, how important was the belief in pushing the Crusaders forward?
Okay. Well, I think personally, I think it's fantastically significant in terms of enabling the Crusaders to persevere and take, at certain points, take enormous risks that might not have been undertaken or faced by an army in a more normative situation. I'm thinking in particular of the decision in the spring of 1099 when the Crusaders, in what we think of now as modern-day Lebanon, and it makes a fairly bold, almost suicidal decision to march straight on Jerusalem without conquering any cities on the way, basically without having any kind of escape route. Conscious of the fact that Jerusalem is going to face the arrival of a relief army from Egypt within weeks, maybe a month and a half, which is what it turns out to be, and that the clock is going to be ticking throughout this period. And that they've got to get to Jerusalem, they've got to take the city, or they're going to die. And I think that is, from the eyewitness testimony, which reveals actually how it was not just the named knights or leaders, but the more ordinary crusaders who were calling, almost baying for this decision to be made and forcing the hands of the leadership. I think we get a sense that is at the heart, religious devotion is at the heart of that decision. At the same time, I've written extensively on this, and there's also a very important element in the first episode of the TV series. There are moments where I think we can try to understand the texture of the First Crusaders' piety in a little bit more detail and a little more in a bit more human light, because it's long been argued that the discovery of the Holy Lance at Antioch in June 1098 was the key catalyst to their decision to then go out and face a Muslim relief army in battle. For me, there's a difficulty in the traditional story about the discovery of the Holy Lance, because it's found by Peter Bartholomew on the 14th of June 1098, but a decision to go to battle is not actually made for another 14 days until the 28th of June. And for a number of years now, I've been fascinated by what happened in those 14 days. Why was there this delay when, according to some eyewitnesses, you get the impression that the Crusaders literally sprinted out of the gates of Antioch after finding the Holy Lance? And there are a number of possibilities, and I think one of the most intriguing is that suggested by the testimony of an Armenian contemporary called Matthew of Edessa, who suggests that the First Crusaders actually considered surrender at this point to the Muslim forces. And to me, that gives a sense that although the Holy Lance provided a boost to morale, it was not all-encompassing or overwhelming. And to me, that gives a slightly more human sense of how these Crusaders may have operated. Even if they thought God was giving them his backing by discovering the Lance, that wasn't enough to send them to their deaths, to what they thought would be suicide, effectively.
Okay, we've got a slightly left-field question here from Katie Engelhart, who asks, how much were Crusaders paid, and how long was the average anti-heretical tour of duty? So, I'm not sure, is there an answer to this?
In terms of duration, the only time when we start to get more of a sense of there being a fixed term is when we get into the late 12th and really into the early 13th century. And in those, once we've got to that sort of more mature, developed period of crusading history where some of the institutions of crusading have been established, then in something like the Albigensian Crusade, a crusade launched into southern France, and the Pyrenees region against Cathar heretics. Then we do see people expecting to only have to fight for 1 month, and that 1 month of, you know, of fighting will be their term, and then they'll go back home. We see something similar on an expedition, for example, the Fifth Crusade into Egypt in the late 1210s and in the early 1220s, where people seem to have expected to fight for, say, a summer period and then return. And it's one of the things we also see changing in this period is the way people get to Crusade is normally now by ship, and therefore it's actually possible for these people to sail into Egypt, do their 3 months, and go home. And while that brings a constant refreshing of manpower, it also leads to quite a lot of destabilization in crusading forces and a lack of ingrained determination to see a war through, reflecting back on what we were talking about earlier on with, say, the First Crusade and their utter determination to reconquer Jerusalem. That seems to ebb somewhat by the time of the Fifth Crusade. But other than that, there aren't, for all crusade forces, a fixed term, and neither is there a fixed term of pay. Again, pay comes into the picture around the time of the Third Crusade. We start to get details of what individual kings are paying knights or those below knights to actually fight, but there's no fixed going rate. And what you can do if you've got enough money is basically buy out someone else's knights so that they'll come over to your side, start fighting for you as opposed to the French king.
If you were paid to go on crusade, if you were a foot soldier paid, would you still get the spiritual benefit of being a crusader in the eyes of the medieval church?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Still on this, on the period of Saladin and the Third Crusade, from James Taughton on Twitter: if Philip II hadn't bottled it and gone home, would the Third Crusade have ended in Saladin's death and Christian victory? Did Philip II bottle it? This is the French king, Philip Augustus.
This is Philip II, Philip Augustus, ruler of the Capetian House of France, rival to the Angevin House, which is, you could call it the English kingdom, but it's also a realm that has control over large swathes of what we now think of French territory. And he's a major participant on the Third Crusade and arrives in Acre shortly before Richard the Lionheart. Arrives in Acre in the spring, summer of 1191. And what's distinctive about Philip is he stays to see the capture of Acre during the Third Crusade, but relatively soon after that, in the middle of the summer, decides to go back home. To say that he bottled it, I think it depends about your perspective. In one way, you could argue he did exactly what you should do if you're a sensible king. And if your priority is actually your kingdom at home, he came and he made his crusading vow. He fulfilled his crusading vow, which is, a lot of kings don't do that. So he actually went on crusade, traveled to the east, did something substantial, helping in a very significant way to take Acre, to move the crusade on, and then realized, I better get home, make sure my kingdom is not falling apart, and look after what's, you know, my primary concern, my crown. Richard didn't do that. And because of that, because Philip had gone back to Europe and was a major rival to the Angevin world, I think from that moment onwards, Richard the Lionheart was constantly wondering about what Philip Augustus was going to do in his absence, whether Richard was actually going to come back to any kind of surviving Angevin realm. So I would argue that one of the contributory factors, going back to the question, is if we think about a counterfactual way of interpreting the Third Crusade, is not so much what Philip would have contributed himself just, but also how that might have affected Richard the Lionheart's mindset and Richard's determination to try to get back to Western Europe when he could, you know, at certain crunch points, especially the spring, summer of 1192. So I think it's there that the real significance comes, not so much in what Philip himself would have done, because the majority of what we would call French crusaders, and these are very imprecise terms at this point, people who'd been in Philip Augustus's contingent, the majority of them stay and one way or another fight alongside Richard the Lionheart through much of the remainder of the Third Crusade.
We've got a tweet from Gareth Barnes, who I'm sure means this in a witty way, so don't take it. What does this series add that wasn't already presented by Terry Jones? Jones was funnier and wore mail. Now, Terry Jones, of course, the Monty Python presented this series on Christmas. There's a broader question here, isn't there? It's like you're a historian, not really out to be funny, but how does making a TV programme gel with being an academic historian?
Okay. Well, I definitely can't argue that I'm funnier than Terry Jones, for sure. I would say one minor thing, which is that I also didn't fire catapult stones or trebuchet stones at a beautiful castle in Turkey, which I'm sure wasn't Terry Jones's own decision, but and during that series, as a young PhD student working on the Principality of Antioch in the early 90s, when that series was being made, I was absolutely aghast to see that once the programme came out that they built a trebuchet and actually fired real stones at a real castle, which just turned out to be my favourite castle in the world, a little-known castle called Kursat, or Kursair, just near the border with Syria. So I didn't do that. I managed to step back from that in the series. On the more substantial, serious point, so I suppose two things. What have we done to advanced understanding, and how does it gel with being an academic? Of course, I can't argue that we've completely rewritten the history of the Crusades or understanding of the Crusades. The series is based on a book that I wrote, which was a single volume history of the Crusades, which took me about 6 years to research and write. And it is very, very closely tied to that. And I think one of the things I'm pleased about and in some ways surprised about is that I do feel that the series is a representation of what I want to say, given the fact we were given 3 hours, no more than 3 hours. The budget we had, the time we had, I think it's the best job that we could have done. And it represents what I would want to say in that period. So I'm not going to come and state, oh, you know, they made me say this, they made me say that. It was a cut down version of what we could have done. Within those constraints, I think it's the best job we could present. Alongside that, what I argued for, and I was very pleased that we managed to hold on to, is that I wanted to have within each episode something that was new. Something that I thought could stand at the core of each episode and help to try to advance general understanding and audiences' understanding and represent my own research. So in episode one, that was the exploration of the impact of the Holy Lance at Antioch and the decision to then go to Venice and see this Armenian manuscript to discuss this alternative view of how the Lance might have affected the progress of this crusade. In episode two, then it was looking at Saladin's taking of Jerusalem in 1187 and the pretty controversial suggestion that he may have intended to actually execute or massacre large sections of the Jerusalemite population at that point, and show the audience that actually that suggestion's not coming from some antagonistic Christian source. It's actually coming from the source closest to Saladin himself, a man called Ahmad al-Din al-Isfahani, a Persian scholar who was, by this point, one of Saladin's scribes, almost his right-hand man, who came to Jerusalem just the day after it fell and is really showing us what Saladin wanted to say about his conquest. So that was at the core of episode two. And episode three, the whole idea of the resonance of the Crusades and how they impact upon world history, and how they may or may not have affected the relationship between Islam and the West, because my current work in setting up a new master's program and a new center of excellence in the study of Islam and the West has made me think about the way where Crusades sit in this much bigger picture a lot over the last couple of years. And that meant that in episode three, one of the things I wanted to do most importantly was to try to give some time to think about what I perceive as the real impact of the Crusades.
Another tweet, which is specifically about the program, from Kaz. How does a non-academic get to view some of the manuscripts that he saw? You looked at some of these lovely illuminated medieval texts all over Europe and the Middle East. Are any of those available to be seen by non-academics?
Not easily. I've picked up a couple of comments online, which I think are quite funny. There's certain places people have said things like, oh, he does a good job of acting excited when he sees things. Well, surely he's seen these things hundreds of times before. And I think people don't realize exactly how difficult some of these archives are to get into and how preciously they protect certain objects. So certainly something like the Melisande Psalter, which is the most beautiful personal prayer book kept in the British Library. Normally, and this was owned by a woman called Queen Melisande, we think, Queen of Jerusalem in the 1130s. and it's a sort of token of her relationship with her husband, King Fulk, but also because of its decoration and its ornamentation, speaks of the world in which she lived. It's no understatement to say that I spent 20 years trying to get close to this document, this object. You can go, usually in what's known as the Joseph Ritblatt Gallery in the British Library, if you can see it open, the actual prayer book itself open to one page. For quite a number of years they had it open in that way there. But it's also very famous for its ivory covers. And they sometimes they go into exhibition, but very often they're just completely kept under lock and key. The elaborate organization to enable us to actually film this was unbelievable. One of the curators spent an entire day working out the route that the box that these things were kept in was going to take through the British Library so that it would never go into any public space from where it's kept in the vaults to the room we were filming in, because he's not permitted to allow it out of any secure location. And they were really, really reticent about letting us anywhere near it. And even I had to have a page turner for that particular manuscript. It's the only manuscript they wouldn't let me actually touch because they're so obsessed with its preservation. And, you know, I can understand that, but I also think there's a balance between that and, exactly as the person who's asking the question states, allowing the public, the world at large, to be able to see these beautiful objects.
So you were genuinely excited?
I was absolutely genuinely excited, yeah.
I mean, it struck me when I was watching the series that highlights one of the issues of being a historian of the Crusades, is that these sources are disparate, spread out all over the place, and also that they're in numerous languages. I mean, you're looking at something in Armenian, Arabic, French, English. I mean, as a Crusades historian, do you need to have proficiency in all these different languages, and can you actually study these documents from afar?
No, well, sometimes you can study them from afar because you can see them in what we call a critical edition, which is where you take as many manuscripts as survive. As an academic, someone will consider the variations in each manuscript when different manuscripts were written, and then produce a printed version. And that printed version might be available in many different libraries around the world. And the truth is, about being a Crusade historian, if you wanted to be the perfect Crusade historian, you probably need to have 10, 12 languages. And I've not met anyone yet who has that full array, because you wouldn't just want medieval Latin, which if you're working from the Western perspective is an absolute must. Arabic, you'd want to have Armenian, Syriac, Greek. There's such an array of sources that you could draw upon to get a full picture. And I don't have that full array of languages. I use what I can. And I consult what I can in terms of manuscripts in original form, but very often we go back to printed editions, and that tends to be the bread and butter for most Crusade historians, is going back to the printed versions, the critical editions, and then only referring to manuscripts where you think there might be a question over a particular reading, a particular presentation of a word.
Is there one sort of language area where it's, you know, unstudied, where people don't, you know, historians just don't have that particular language, and sort of there might be some interesting insights to come from someone who was able to develop a skill in that language area?
I think there is. I think Armenian, for example, is a very underrepresented language not in terms of scholarship generally, although surely there could be, you know, more Armenian specialists, but people who are working on the Crusades using Armenian documents. And there are a number, but I think there's much to be said for the further study of that, not least because Christian Armenia becomes a major player in the Northern Crusader states in the late 12th and into the early 13th century, and becomes a vital ally for those Northern Crusader states. And the source base, I think, could be, you know, much could be done with that, with closer reading both of the printed editions and the manuscripts.
What should we do next? Oh, here's a good question from John Giebfried from St. Louis, who emailed.
He's an ex-student.
Ah, right, okay. Well, he's asking the question, who is responsible for numbering the Crusades, and why were some, for instance, the Albigensian and the Children's Crusades, not numbered?
Well, it's the result really of 19th and 20th century scholarship, which is very much an imposition on the medieval world, as opposed to a reflection of the way in which most medieval contemporaries would have thought about crusading history. We could even debate whether it's right to call the First Crusade the First Crusade. We now look at it and think of it as the first of its type. Certainly was seen as something new to medieval contemporaries, but they didn't have a word crusade at the time that it occurred. So for them, it was known as a pilgrimage, a journey, carrying out the work of God. And it was only in the late 1180s, 1130s, that we start to see the emergence of words like Cruce Signatus, one who bears the symbol of the cross, from which eventually we get words like the French word croisade, bearer of the cross, which leads to crusade. And then in the 19th and 20th century, we see an increasing move to try to categorize these different crusades, to identify crusading ventures that were deemed to be the big crusades, the major crusades of the 12th and 13th century. So, for example, from the First Crusade, we get to the Second Crusade, preached in 1144, which leads to actual military action between 1147-49. But there were, arguably, a number of crusades preached in between that, that were smaller ventures, had fewer men, sometimes very few men, and some of which were not just to the Holy Land. Already we see in the 1120s the preaching of what looks like a crusade into the Iberian Peninsula. So depending on how you number the crusades, you could come up with a very different total from the 8 or 9 major crusades that are sometimes described from the classic period, 1095 to 1291. You could get up into the 10s, the 20s, even perhaps even beyond that total. And I think it's where it's worth being aware of this is, and realizing this, is the degree to which we as modern historians are affecting and interpreting and to some degree manipulating our understanding of the past. We're putting shape on it that might not, and that shape might not have been apparent to people actually living in the Middle Ages.
So in the sense, does the ordering the Crusades slightly hamper academic study then, in a sense, sort of lead you to look in one direction in a Victorian way in some way?
I think it does to an extent. It gives you a sense that just using the word gives you the idea that there was a very distinct identity to this idea of crusading right from the start. And I think that is very misleading. I think it's a much more malleable and ill-defined idea through, for example, the first 50 years of its existence, through the first half of the 12th century. It wasn't necessarily a war that had to be fought against Muslims in that period. There's been a long debate over an early example of a crusade being what we now would call, being diverted against a different enemy. Actually, is a crusade preached against the Byzantine Empire, against the Eastern Christian Empire, with its base at Constantinople. And historians long argued that this is extraordinary. How could crusading so recently after its birth be diverted, be maligned in this way to go against supposedly a natural ally? And to me, actually, what that represents is not some kind of diversion or misdirection of crusading. It's just a natural expression of the fact that crusading hasn't really got a set identity at this point, and we've imposed that identity as historians from afar.
Okay. Had a tweet from someone who I think is actually one of your current students, Andrew Buck. Does that ring a bell?
It certainly does. One of my very skilled and talented PhD students.
So I asked him to come up with a question that would be really difficult for you, but he declined that opportunity and instead asked, who is your favourite figure from the crusading era? Is there someone who you particularly find interesting?
Wow, that's a tough... That is actually quite a tough question. Not academically tough, but personally tough. I'm not sure I could come up with one. If you'll allow me two.
Certainly.
So I'll have one famous one and one less famous one. Mm-hmm. If I was going to go for the famous one, I couldn't really escape Saladin. If I was going to be, if I was going to critique my own work, and if I was going to try to undermine my own book on the Crusades, I would argue really that the Crusades, in real terms, is a very extended biography of Saladin. I mean, it's a kind of very heavily contextualized biography of Saladin, where you get to hear everything that happened before him and everything that happened after him, but it allows you to understand him as a man. And I can't deny that for a good 5 years or so, I was utterly fascinated by his career and really immersed myself in the material surrounding his life. And I guess the thing that makes him so extraordinary to me is that you, every now and again, you get a glimpse of him as a human being, and the kind of humanity that peers through that you don't see necessarily in other individuals, in part because they may have been more tyrannical, more despotic, more ruthless. And I think all of those characteristics are elements within Saladin's makeup. We shouldn't see him as some kind of perfectly pious, gentle and clement idealized ruler. He certainly wasn't that. But I think he is a man, if you understand him in his context, who stands apart from the medieval norm in that he is, by the standards of his day, more interested in the ideas of justice. Certainly, I would argue, from around 1186, more devoted and determined to fight in the name of the cause he's chosen, which is the taking of Jerusalem and then the defense of Jerusalem in the interests of Islam. And I'm persuaded that if you do what I've tried to do, which is to really put him in context, that's when he stands apart. That's where he becomes most remarkable. And for someone who's less well known, it's partly not just so much, I guess, the figure himself, but it's also just the fun actually being a medieval historian and actually recovering the life of someone who no one else really cares about. That in itself is kind of a particular joy. And so that would have to be someone called Robert Fitzfulk the Leper, who was an early settler in the Principality of Antioch, held a number of strategically important sites in the Principality, seems at one point to have even established a friendship with a local Muslim ruler of Damascus in the 11 teens. And was a major player in the Principality. But one of the things that makes him so fascinating is he's subsequently captured by this same Muslim leader and actually executed. Having thought that he was going to get clement treatment, the Muslim ruler, Tughtigin, decides to decapitate him on the spot and have his head turned into a jewel-encrusted drinking cup. And I guess it's that sort of combination of his life, his fascinating name, Fitzfulk the Leper. We know very little about his life, whether he was a leper, whether he was the son of a leper. And then his slightly grim ending, which always made him an attractive character for me.
Right. We've got a couple here which I'll conflate because I suspect you might want to answer in the same way. One from Dan Oencia, which is, why did they stop crusading? And one from James Aitchison, why were there no concerted efforts by the Latins to reconquer the Holy Land after the fall of Acre in 1291?
Okay. So, well, I mean, one answer is to say that they didn't stop crusading and they didn't give up entirely on the Holy Land. So the fall of Acre in 1291 certainly prompted a reaction in the West. It prompted a high degree of shock, of questioning, not least the questioning of, you know, if this is God's work, if God supports the idea of crusading, how can this have occurred? And it prompted, for example, the writing of a whole series of treatises on the idea of what must now be done to reconquer the Holy Land. And in the late 13th and on into the 14th century, there was lots of talk of launching further crusades, further crusading ventures, some of which got off the ground in small scale, very briefly even in 1365. A crusading force managed for a short period of time to take control of Alexandria in Egypt. And then in future decades and centuries, crusading as an idea did continue to be utilized by what we'd now call the Catholic Church. But most crusades were then targeted either against heretics, against Muslim opponents in Eastern Europe, such as the Ottomans, or against the political enemies of the papacy. So it's not as if the idea of crusading disappeared off the radar entirely after 1291. There is, however, I think, an interesting subtext to the question, which is in a way to say, well, how did it happen? How did 1291 happen? How shocked was Europe really that the Holy Land had fallen? And I think it's easy to imagine somehow that every single person who lived in Western Europe every morning woke up, you know, with dawn and thought to themselves, my God, what's happening in the Holy Land? You know, they're utterly obsessed with it, that they thought about it every moment of their waking lives. And I think that is entirely an illusion. I think the fate of the Holy Land, the fate of what we now call the Crusader States, was significant, but it was never enough to completely drive Western Europe in terms of a war effort, in terms of continuing a constant flow of supply, support, manpower to the embattled Near East. And that's largely because it's geographically distant, because, of course, it's, Europe itself is far from a peaceful and placid environment. There are lots of localized wars, localized difficulties taking place that are obsessing population and ruling elites. And so the distant Holy Land often takes second place or even fourth or fifth place alongside those other considerations. And I guess it's important to recognize that 1291, the fall of Acre, did not come out of the blue. There had been many moments along the path to that event where disasters were occurring, where the West was alive to the fact that this was a downhill slope that they were, you know, hurtling down, and that many appeals had come from the Holy Land requesting assistance, and almost all of these had been ignored. And I think why it's so important to recognize this is just, you know, to recognize not everyone was obsessed, not everyone was focused or channeling their energy towards the defense of the Holy Land. It was a peripheral war, a frontier war.
Let's move on to one from Michael Rantzer, who's particularly interested in what happened to the Jewish population in the Crusades. He wants to know how large was the Jewish population, and did they play any role in the battles, and how were they treated by the Crusaders during and after battle, in contrast to how Muslims were treated? Lots of questions there.
Okay, so I'm assuming the question is to do with Jews living in the Near and Middle East,
yes,
as opposed to Jewish populations in Europe, because obviously they experience some horrors at the hands of armies like the First Crusaders, who carry out pogroms against the Jews in the Rhineland before they actually leave Europe and head for the Holy Land. So in terms of the treatment, survival and treatment of the Jewish population in what we might call the Crusader States, I think we have to avoid sort of the extremities of the argument. So one suggestion has been in the past, for example, that when Jerusalem is taken, the entire population of Jerusalem in 1099, both Muslim and Jewish, is massacred. I don't think the closest and best evidence bears that out. And I'm here talking about something like the Geniza documents, the Geniza letters written by the Jewish population towards the end of the 11th century. Closest eyewitness testimony we really have to these events, reflecting that Jews did survive in Jerusalem, as did Muslims, that the total number of dead was certainly less than 70,000, which is the highest estimate we get from Muslim testimony. So I don't think Jews are entirely wiped out in something like the Kingdom of Jerusalem. However, we shouldn't swing the pendulum fully to the other direction and say that the new Christian overlords of the Near East were suddenly far more tolerant and understanding of Jewish populations within their lands. Because what becomes clear when you look at the 12th and 13th century world of, say, the Kingdom of Jerusalem, is that what mattered was not just being a Christian, but actually being a Western European Christian, and that it was something of a two-tier society in that way, in which even Eastern Christians were categorized as very different from Western Christians. And so you have the kind of the crowd or the group that are part of the ruling elite, those from what we call the Latin West, and then Jews, Eastern Christians, Muslim population, largely bundled together as a secondary group of population. And so I suppose the treatment sits somewhere between massacre and full coexistence. It's somewhere in the middle ground.
Okay. We'll just do one more, I think, which is a fairly specific tweet. I failed to take down the tweeter's name, but I'll find that and record it afterwards. Why didn't you talk about the German Crusades of the 13th century in your TV series? I presume there's a fairly simple reason that you only had 3 hours, but
yeah.
You want to?
Well, I think there's a more fundamental question at the heart of that, which is how you organise your material, I guess. And an easy answer would be to just say, well, exactly, you just said we had 3 hours, and what are you going to put in 3 hours? And that is that is a very tough task to decide what goes in, what doesn't go in. And there is, you know, an ocean of material that I had to put to one side. Some of my most treasured events from this period, you know, some of the things, some of the analysis, some of the individuals, some of the sources that are most important to me that didn't make it anywhere near the series. I think more substantively, however, something I'd want to say is that I do believe that if you're going to try to make something comprehensible for a general audience, and you're going to try to allow an audience to follow a subject that is as encompassing as the Crusades, that covers two centuries of history, and could easily have taken it to five centuries and beyond if we wanted to look at later crusading in other theatres of war. If you want to do that, then you have to find some kind of principles that will allow you to give shape. And so my principle, both in writing the book on which the series is based and lay at the heart of the series as well, was to look at what we call the War for the Holy Land, so the contest for control of Jerusalem and the wider Holy Land. And that contest being fought between the start of the First Crusade, 1095, and the fall of Acre in 1291. And that lay at the heart of how I organize my material for my book, and lay at the heart of the structure of this three-part series. And I wouldn't represent what I've written in my book or in the series as a history of the total crusading past in any shape or form. It is a slice of crusading history, and I think certainly in a three-part series that's the best that we can offer.
Actually, there is one more thing that plays on from it, which is a tweet from Colf's History Department. Does serious historical revisionism ever premiere on telly? I suppose there's a question about how far you can present something which is a revision of other people's views on a given topic on TV when people may not know what the original view was. So how difficult is that to, you know, present an academic argument when you've also confined by having to present a narrative for a TV audience?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. And I go back to what I said earlier on, that really I held on to the idea that in each episode I would try to do that once. And to be honest, I feel fairly lucky that we were able to do it once, because the most difficult thing is to stop your narrative and say, well, hang on a minute, this is what we thought, this is what this historian thought, this is what this historian thought, and now I'm going to tell you this. And I think in most circumstances in television, what you are unable to do is to talk at any great length about what people have thought before. You pretty much have to just set it up and say, this is the established understanding, now I'm going to tell you what my view is. And that is a bit reductive, and it is simplifying events, and it's rejecting this idea or turning away from this idea that history might go and be cyclical in terms of interpretation, that history might be very much open to interpretation, and that there isn't a singular truth at the heart of our understanding of this past. But within the confines of 1 hour of television, I think it's hard to go any further than that.
So was there one story that you really wanted to get in that you were unable to? If you'd had 3 hours and 10 minutes, what would be the story you'd have slotted in?
Wow, that's a really tough question. Well, we shot it and it didn't go in, so I'll tell you about that. We actually went to Petra for two, three days to shoot some extraordinary material about the early settlement of the Crusader states. So Petra is the most remarkable series of ruins, a ruined civilization from the Nabataean period, so centuries before the advent of the Crusades, in Jordan. And within the confines of Petra itself, there's one Crusader castle that survives. And just on the fringes of the ruins of Petra, another Crusader castle was also built. And we went to both of these sites to talk about the difficulties of settling in the Holy Land, and especially in a place like Petra in modern-day Jordan, very much an arid desert environment. And we were able to persuade an archaeological team to bring along the skeletal remains of bodies they'd found buried in rock-cut graves in this second castle, Al-Waira. And It was an extraordinary moment. We sat in amongst these ruins, and I held the bones of an 8 to 12 month old child who had died in the Holy Land during this early wave of settlement, almost certainly because of malnutrition, because they were unable to adjust their diet to the needs of the Levant, and also unable to get enough fresh fruit in this slightly hostile environment in which they were living. And for me, because I'm not an archaeologist, very simple terms, it's remarkable, it's extraordinary to come that close to the physical remains of someone who lived through this world. And at the same time, it evoked this idea of how fragile the Latin Christian or Western Christian foothold in the Near East was in the early 12th century. So that was a story I very much wanted to tell. It was also, not surprisingly, given how amazing Petra is, visually it was utterly fantastic. Just proved to be impossible to get it into episode two.
Thank you very much for that, for answering those wide-ranging questions. I think you've demonstrated your depth of scholarship there by being able to talk about, everything, pretty much everything about the Crusades there, I think we covered. So thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
That was Tom Asbridge. His most recent book, The Crusades, The War for the Holy Land, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks to all of you who sent questions in, and apologies to Mark Douglas for missing his details at the end there. It was he who asked the question about the German Crusades. I think this made for a very interesting discussion, but you may disagree. So if you like what we've done here, we can do more Ask the Historian slots. So if you just tell me if you think this is a good or bad approach, by the usual mechanisms, that's via Twitter, twitter.com/historyextra, facebook.com/historyextra, or just by email to podcast@historyextra.com, then we'll see whether we should carry on with it. And if you do like the format and want more, it would be great to know what subjects, themes, or historians you'd like us to try and cover in the future. That's it for this week's episode. Just a reminder that if you want to take up the offer of the free issue, you need to call the number 0844-776-0306. That offer is only available for UK delivery addresses and is subject to availability. So if you do want to get hold of a free copy of BBC History Magazine, call that number before 29th February. BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson. Next week, we'll be looking at the influential Tudor tome known as Fox's Book of Martyrs. Thank you, as ever, for listening. I hope you'll stay with us for our next 100 editions.